Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here on the Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. As we jump into our conversation, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to testing, you can learn more about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. We're now joined by two men who have been to Greece and other places where Syrian refugees are pouring in. They've been working with those refugees. We saw the attack in Brussels that will clearly affect what happens to people on the ground and the agreement between the EU, the European Union, and Turkey and how that affects the life of refugees. But I don't think we understand the intensity of all that and what all that means. We're joined by Bill O'Keefe, who's Vice President for Government Relations and Advocacy for Catholic Relief Services. Bill, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
Ryan Harvey, local musician, activist, writer, and co-founder of Firebrand Records, who spent the month of February in Lesbos with a team assembled from the U.S. doing work with refugees and construction and more. Ryan, good to have you in the studio.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Email us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Do join in the conversation, 410-319-8888. So, Bill, so talk about where you were and what you did, just briefly, to get a listener's sense of that.
Great. So in December, I went to Greece, to Macedonia, and to Serbia, and basically kind of followed the pipeline at the time of the refugees who were moving from Turkey to Greece and then up north towards Germany and Sweden primarily. And there I saw the various reception centers that Catholic Relief Services and other groups are supporting on the pipeline, that the kind of the choke points where people are crossing borders. And there we're providing food, water, emergency health care, psychological counseling, and legal assistance and information, so that we're trying to fill the vacuum of rumor and confusion that so clouds people's ability to make good decisions along the way. And that's what I did.
And why you went where and why?
I was in the northeast corner of the island of Lesbos,
which is part of Greece.
Yeah, which is about 6 to 7 kilometers from the Turkish border over the ocean. That's the main entry point. That's the vast majority of refugees from any country who've entered Europe last year and this year come through Greece, and the majority of those come through Lesbos.
And you were doing what there?
All sorts of things, but primarily I was like sleeping on isolated beaches in a tent with one or two people, waiting for boats in the middle of the night. Most of the landings we would get would be in the middle of the night, so we'd have lookout points with like night vision, and we would have, we'd be coordinating with rescue boats on the phone and stuff to try to predict where a boat was going to land, and then provide transportation and emergency care and conversation.
Can you give us a sense, both of you, and Bill, I'm going to start with you, just want listeners to get kind of a more vivid understanding of what it was like for you, but as importantly, more importantly, what it was like for the people that you saw, the Syrian Afghan refugees who kind of were flooding through here, and what life was like and who they were.
Yeah, I met a lot of amazing people, and I guess I would share the following kind of impressions. One is folks were really generally pretty well educated. Syrians are extremely well educated people. They had many stories of living normal lives of the type that we recognize and feel see a lot of similarities with their own lives here. And then as a result of this civil war, they experienced bombing, forced conscription of young male members of their family, and fear of both the government and the opposition and these different opposition groups. And most of them had moved within Syria a couple times before making the difficult decision to leave, and had found themselves in Turkey or Lebanon and Jordan, spent time generally living in an urban area, not in a camp setting, but really trying to piece together a life and watching their assets decline, and finally coming to a point where they're felt there was they weren't going to be able to go back. And so you know, somebody who makes the decision to cross the water that Ryan witnessed, these very dangerous water crossings, they perceive that that is safer than the situation that they were leaving from. And I think that's really the thing to keep in mind. The bar is so high for people to make this journey that It just shows you how desperate they are and how bad the conditions are that they're fleeing.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that I've read and talked to some friends here who are both Afghan and Syrian and Iraqi descent and live there, is that the people coming in were from all political sides in this conflict. Mm-hmm. Oh, they were just fleeing the terror, fleeing the violence, people being murdered and killed by the thousands. I think we have a sense of how horrendous that is.
Yeah, and I mean, I also visited the largest refugee camp in the Netherlands, in the city of Nijmegen, and the vast majority were Syrian. And the people I interviewed there said that, you know, they don't really talk politics. It's sort of like there's everyone from Syria is there, and they sort of just don't. They leave it alone. But you have to understand also that, you know, like just in one morning, we had a boat with 180 people, and there was people there from Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Eritrea, Somalia, you know, Algeria, people from all over the place. And there's this big tension in Europe, I think, of who's considered a legitimate and a not legitimate refugee. And so you've got areas of northern Pakistan that are just as dangerous as southern Afghanistan.
And Waziristan and other – right, right.
Absolutely. Right. The Taliban and ISIS don't recognize that border, right? So there's also that tension. But you did have people from all over. And I mean, we had people – you know, obviously, like, we had doctors. We had former interpreters for the U.S. military or the British military. We had a lot of young people, a lot of children. And we had one example is a young Afghan man I met one night named Samir, who could have crossed legally into Europe because he had a visa and he had, I think he had even studied in Europe, but his little brother couldn't. So he went back to Afghanistan and he made the journey with his little brother by foot from Afghanistan to Turkey and then in a boat to Greece. So you have, you know, I think there's a perception that it's like, oh, it's just this people trying to take this easy route to get into Europe. And
right.
The stuff they've been through even before they get to the boat is crazy.
And the situation is still completely in limbo for most of these people. And how many people are we talking about?
Well, there are 11 million displaced people from Syria itself, which is approximately half of the population.
Million.
And over 4 million of those are refugees. And so there's another 7 or 8 million displaced within Syria still, which is kind of an incredible number of people, obviously. So, four and a half million, you know, counting is tough here, but 4.5 million Syrians are refugees in other countries right now. It's the largest refugee crisis since the end of the Second World War. It's an absolutely... and that's one of the things that really hit me on this trip was at the time, 4,000 or 5,000 people were passing through the areas where I was every single day. That's just an unbelievable number of people.
Yep.
And that's just a small number compared to the people who are actually stuck as refugees.
That's right. Yep. I mean, compared to the 1.5 million people in Lebanon, for example, a country of 4 million where almost a quarter or a third of its population are Syrian are refugees. That's like having 70 million refugees show up in the United States in 4 years. Lebanon is actually dealing with it in its way with a lot of help, you know. But still, it gives you a sense of this the kind of the relative scale of this the situation.
Yeah. And you've got, you know, Syria, you know, 11% of the population has been killed or injured. They've had like a 22% decrease in their population. Or I should, not a 22% decrease, but 22% of their population is gone.
Killed.
Or refugees.
Or refugees,
yeah.
Right.
And Lebanon's the size of Delaware, and they have 1.5 million. So when you hear Europe talking about how there's this crisis in Europe, the crisis in Europe is a political crisis. It's not actually an infrastructure crisis. It's a crisis of their willingness to bring people in. And for the U.S., I mean, we could talk about the U.S., but I think last year the U.S. brought in 1,700 Syrian refugees. And the same year, we gave $1.5 billion to armed groups in Syria to perpetuate the civil war. And this year so far, I think we've taken in under 1,000 so far Syrian refugees. So we have a lot to own up to.
So, yeah, what about the political question of the refugees? Because, I mean, it's a political football in the United States. It's a political issue in Europe. And these refugees, as you said, Ryan, are coming from Syria, but they're also going to come from Somalia and Eritrea, where war is happening. So the Sudan, which is it has the largest refugee population in the world, singly is inside of Sudan, and that are internally internal refugees. And so, I mean, this is a huge issue, but a real political football. So the Let me talk about the politics of the refugee world, then a bit about the politics of what causes the refugee world and how to respond to it. But a bit about the politics of all this.
Yeah, I think
– No, that's not your area, but I know you know a great deal about it.
Yeah, so. No, thank you. It's a totally legitimate question on this issue, obviously. I mean, the United States has been we're a country of refugees. I mean, just about most – all of us who aren't Native Americans are refugees, came as refugees or migrants in one way or another.
Or enslaved people.
Exactly. Thank you. And we have a long tradition of welcoming, but this crisis, I think we're trying to communicate that the Syrians are the most vetted people in the entire world. Our process in the United States mm-hmm. is people go through 13 federal agencies. It takes over 2 years. It is an incredibly thorough process, and the people who are coming here are fleeing the people that we're afraid of, actually. They're not the people we're afraid of. The refugees are the ones who are the women and the children and the young men who are fleeing the exact people who people fear. And they have a lot to offer our country, and we feel very strongly that we can do a lot more as a country to take on more, particularly of the most vulnerable people, people who are not going to be able to go back for political or other reasons. And there's lots of people who fit that definition. And we're confident that our government has in place the processes to make sure that the people who come here are legitimate refugees.
So what do you think politically has to happen at this moment to deal with this massive crisis of people fleeing the wars in their countries? It's not all, but many of those wars being fueled by the West, and we have some responsibility in some ways for this refugee crisis because of what we've torn asunder throughout the Middle East and the Near East.
Absolutely.
And now we have these people who are fleeing for their lives. And maybe people say, "Well, but they're fleeing for lives, but there might be people hiding among them who will come blow us up," and that's kind of part of the argument against it. So what is How do we begin to tackle this political question about what happens to these millions of people who want to get west and get out?
I think the first thing to understand is that the idea that people are posing as refugees to commit terrorist attacks is an invented mythology that was invented by the right wing, right? That's not the story of 9/11, for instance. All those people entered legally with visas and all of this stuff. Organizations like Al-Qaeda or ISIS, there's this myth that they're like this ragtag group and you know, no, they're professional fighters. This is what they do. They've done it for a very long time. They're going to get in if they want to get in, right? Like, this is what they do. That's their whole mission. ISIS has their centrality in Syria, of course, but they do send people abroad. The refugee question, when I hear Americans saying, oh, we need to keep these refugees out, you know, my babysitter from childhood was killed in Iraq. And so when I hear somebody say that we can't let these people in, what I think is, okay, so it was fine to send all these people to quote, liberate this country, but then the people that you claim to be liberating, you don't want to, you know, they should deal with the situation. You shouldn't have to adjust your life, you know? And I think the question is, it's a big question, but I think what we were talking earlier, it has a simple answer, and I compare it to perhaps the civil rights movement, which is either the country changes or the country doesn't change. And Europe is facing that even more so right now, where it's a question of what's Europe going to look like from here on out? Are they going to go back to the Europe of the last century, or are they going to become a new thing with more open borders that adjusts its culture to fit changing situations in the world, because the Middle East is changing due to all of this conflict?
And open borders are like an anathema to most countries. And most, when you even question the notion of open borders, even though if you watch clips of Ronald Reagan speaking in 1980, he talked about opening the borders between Mexico and the United States. People seem to forget that. Even Ronald Reagan himself said that. But so politically, what does this mean beyond ARC saying we got to help the refugees, and groups like Catholic Relief Services is in the midst of saving lives as they're stuck in these camps? But beyond that, there has to be an answer.
Well, I mean, I think there's some really important lessons that lead to steps that need to be taken. One is we're never going to be able to resettle or assist our way out of this. And so negotiated, serious U.S. leadership to negotiate an end to the fighting in Syria is the only way that's mm-hmm. going to stop the the catastrophic level of this crisis, because most Syrians that I've talked to, and it'd be interesting if Ryan shares this, but most Syrians I've talked to, they would rather stay. They did not seek this.
Right.
And so so it's in everybody's interest and theirs that we find a way to stop this fighting and so people can focus on reliving their lives where they are. Second of all, for the EU, the big lesson is this crisis, they did not deal with the crisis early on in a comprehensive, compassionate way. And there was this very hodgepodge response, lack of information, confusion, and that's really worsened the whole situation. And I think if there's a lesson here for the future is they and we need to get our act together so that there is a universal approach to this that is compassionate, that helps people in need, and that is clear. And in the absence of that, this is what you get. You get smugglers, you get confusion, you get people dying in the water, and there's a real lesson there. And it's not too late for the EU to continue to get better at that, frankly, and we, the United States, can help. Finally, we can continue to meet the needs on the ground, and we can address the long-term needs of people in these refugee situations in neighboring countries so we don't have a lost generation of kids who miss 5 years of education. And that's a real focus for us. We need to get kids back into school. We're working on that. Other groups are. It's a huge priority.
Schools inside the camps.
Schools inside Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey. Not in camp situations. Most people, 90% are not in camps. They're living in informal settings or in kind of tenement housing or however you want to.
So what about the housing?
Oh, well, the you know, Europe, on the European front, Europe also is having a significant internal crisis in what is the EU. Will the EU exist in a couple years? And that started, of course, with the economic crisis. But then again, so did the situation. The Arab Spring was a significant cause of that was economic crisis in 2008, the beginning of the price of bread going up, the price of fuel going up, the dictatorships becoming further illegitimate. But the engine driving, like you said, that we're plugging holes. Like when I go to Lesbos, I'm just plugging up little holes. You know, 1,000, 2,000 people every night are showing up. Still, Saturday night, 1,600 people showed up. We're just plugging holes. The engine driving all of these refugees, the main engine, is war and violence. And that's being perpetuated by a lot of different players. But we as Americans, you know, the second largest group of refugees coming are from Afghanistan, where we've been at war since 2001. They're fleeing violence and they're fleeing economic destabilization. And I think that the U.S. has significantly failed both in, because there's so much politics involved, in providing actual security in these places, but more significantly probably is providing like real economic solutions to what these countries are dealing with.
So two things, just in terms of the realpolitik of the moment and where we are. So what does this agreement mean that just happened between the EU and Turkey, stopping refugees from coming back and staying in Turkey? What does that mean, given that with Turkey's response to the refugee crisis as well?
Well, I'm going to find the positive in it, which is that it's at least puts in place some sort of more orderly regime. And the if they do what they say they're going to do, which is focus more on people coming through a more kind of orderly process of getting to Europe as opposed to going across the water in a smuggler's boat, you know, that would be a good thing. But in reality, Europe is paying Turkey to $6 billion to deal with its problem. And Turkey's getting something out of it. And you know, I'm in no position to judge that either way. But it is an incomplete solution. It's not clear whether it will work. And we already see two problems. One, along the way, an increase in smuggling. Fewer people, but more smuggling. Because whenever you sort of like—
Of people.
Of people. More smuggling of people. And second of all, and I know Ryan can talk about this too— there's a lot of initially people sent kind of their young, healthy male family member ahead to Germany to establish kind of a to scope out the situation. And this, you know, we did this. My family did this, too, you know, from Ireland generations ago. And now you have these young guys are up there and the women and children, many of them are stuck in Turkey. that's not a tenable situation. And, you know, at the Catholic Church and CRS, we're always concerned about family split and family unification. And so if this is pouring concrete on that kind of family disunity, that's a big problem.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I think that the problem is the political situation is so intractable that what you're doing in Catholic Relief and what you were doing in the island may become the mainstay of the work, because I don't I have a hard time picturing how this crisis is going to unfold for the refugees themselves.
And these types of groups, like these NGOs and these grassroots groups, they're the ones doing the work. So part of this agreement is Europe trying to assert some sort of control over a situation that they haven't been that involved in. When I was there, yeah, you'd see the Portuguese Frontex boat go by. Frontex is the EU's border patrol, basically. You'd see these boats, the Greek Coast Guard, but all of the work was being done by volunteers and NGOs. So this agreement comes out, and this agreement comes from so many places. It comes from Germany trying to fix the problem before their elections last week, trying to come up with a solution. Because everyone's turning towards them and blaming them. It's Turkey just taking full advantage of the EU's crisis and getting a bunch of money. Basically, in the back rooms, you can rest assured that there is an agreement between Turkey and the EU saying, you let us do what we want inside of our country, because Turkey's bombing Kurdish communities in the east, southeast of Turkey. Hush up about that. You let us do our thing. We'll help you work your way out of your crisis, whatever. It's all politics in there. But Greece, at the end of the day, Greece doesn't have the infrastructure to deal with this. The EU doesn't even have the infrastructure. They say they're going to deport between 1 and 2,000 people every day. How? We never even saw the Greek authorities for the month I was there. They're not there. Back to Turkey. And then they have this bizarre agreement, which is like a Syrian for a Syrian. So for every Syrian, and I don't know how they came up with this idea, every Syrian that they get on the water, arrest, deport back to Turkey, they'll take another Syrian from Turkey and bring them to Europe. What kind of conversation led to that agreement? It's just so weird. But the agreement, I should add, has already been put into question several times, especially today. Both the UNHCR, which is the UN's High Commission on Refugees, and Doctors Without Borders, two very significant NGOs working in Greece, both pulled out of the main refugee camp on Lesvos in protest, saying that it's being turned into a detention center. They don't want to be involved in deportations. It's inhumane and could be against international law. So that's thrown a lot into question as well today.
Bill O'Keefe?
In terms of Turkey, I think Turkey's been very generous in terms of receiving refugees and they're in a tough position as well, and which is why I said I don't really – myself, I don't think we're able to really assess their what they're getting out of it or not and all that. But from the EU perspective, definitely there's some real questions about whether they'll deliver. One of the things they committed to was to provide, I think, 500 experts – to come down and help process, and that still is not happening, as I understand. And so, it does remain to be seen whether how this will all play out. But I think, you know, it's always kind of darkest before the dawn, as we say. And I think the hope is a political solution around inside Syria. That's actually where we have to put our hope. And the fact that the Secretary of State has put so much political capital on that is right now in Moscow, and I'm sure having discussions with the Russians about this. You know, we just have to really push our government to keep on task, to do everything possible to end this war, because that's I think Ryan's absolutely right, that the EU and all these other countries, they are losing control of this situation, are not going to be able to manage it as long as we allow the hemorrhaging to continue on the ground.
Yeah, it's clear. You can see just politically speaking that all the rhetoric, the anti-Assad rhetoric, has been really toned down in the last 6 months by the West, by America and the EU, because I mean there's no solving the Syrian problem and thinking you're just going to get rid of Assad, then that's going to get rid of the problem. It's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So that's also part of this equation, I think, that people have to figure out. And I guess what just happened in Brussels, I mean, just the other day in Cote d'Ivoire, the people were killed on the beach by dozens, and we didn't say much, but Brussels we were focusing on. But what happened in Brussels seems to me will have an effect on this refugee crisis.
Yeah, of course it will. And I mean, just like in the U.S., it doesn't even matter if those guys that are behind the attack, right? I think they're from Belgium. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if they're refugees or not. The European right wing is very strong right now. And the same thing happened a few months ago in Cologne in Germany. There were these sexual assaults on New Year's.
I remember that.
And they blamed it all on refugees. And then it comes out that actually, you know, the main story involving refugees from that night was from a woman who was getting sexually assaulted. And a group of Syrian refugees saved her and formed a human ring around her and beat up the attackers. So it didn't matter. It sounded believable. So that's good enough for them, you know? Just like the San Bernardino shooting happened, and then all of a sudden Trump and Hogan are out saying, yeah, we have to keep these Syrian refugees out. Didn't matter that no one involved in the San Bernardino shooting was a refugee or a Syrian. It doesn't matter. It sounds right. So, you know, but that's where – and it's not just Donald Trump. There's leaders just like Trump all over Europe right now. There's parties just like that.
Right.
It's clear, you know, there are security concerns that are legitimate that our government has to worry about and political leaders need to be concerned about in terms of, you know, actual members of ISIS who are actually trying to harm Americans and other innocent people. And that's a serious problem. I don't want to minimize that in the least. But I think we do have to be really smart and really discerning here. And it isn't the refugees who are fleeing violence who are the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the more we focus our efforts on the wrong problem, the less smart we're going to be on dealing with the real problem. And so let's focus on helping the refugees, ending the war, getting better at integrating our refugees into our society in ways that allow them to make a contribution, and then we're all going to be better for that. And then focus our efforts at dealing with these security concerns where they belong, which is the real people who are trying to cause us harm, not the people who are fleeing those people and finding themselves on our shores and other shores.
Yeah, I mean, I think the intractableness of this is what gets to me, and that. I know it's always darkest before the dawn, as you said, which is a great saying, but I just don't know what time of night it is. You know, because the idea of really addressing what's happening in Syria at this moment, and the war is such a huge piece. I don't see anybody coming up with real solutions to this.
Well, there's a cessation of hostilities right now. Lots to criticize, but there is progress, and our people who are in relationship with people who know inside Syria say there is reduced bombing and some sense of hope. So, you know, I think that is progress. That is progress. I mean, and if we were to use some of our diplomatic leverage to try to get the Iranians and the Saudis to stop using Syria as a proxy war, if we and Russia stopped using Syria as a proxy war, it would be a serious contribution.
Yeah. So it's been a great conversation. First of all, I want to thank you both for what you've been doing in this work. I think it's really important. Bill O'Keefe, Vice President for Government Relations and Advocacy for Catholic Relief Services, who just came back with different refugee centers in several different countries. Ryan Harvey, who's a local musician, activist, writer, co-founder of Firebrand Records, who spent the month of February in Lesbos working with refugees. And by the way, Ryan will be speaking along with Marcos Pastekas-Kokovis, reporting back on the refugee crisis on the Greek islands. He'll be speaking tomorrow night at 7:30 p.m. at Red Emma's, and you can join him there to hear more about what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And thank both of you for what you've been doing. This is really very important work, and I appreciate the work that you've both been doing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we are going to take a very different turn in our conversation today and look at the world of black comics as the East Coast Black Age of Comics Convention is coming to Baltimore. Stay with us.